rocky bottoms before, and Annie always manages to find further depths.
4. Annie. Luke, you keep telling me I need to connect with my pain, and I do understand the logic of that, although I'm not even sure yet that I'll ever let you read that I wrote that down. And I'd rather die than admit it aloud. I'm going to start from the day after I got the notebook, because that's when it started. The glacial slide from when my life was worth something to the mess I'm in now. I woke up excited that day. I came down the stairs with my notebook in my hands, and I was a ball of pure anticipation about the summer break. Then I saw Mom and Lexi at the kitchen table, and the excitement turned into shock, and the shock turned into dread. They were sitting opposite one another, a pile of crumpled tissues on the table between them. Captain Edwards was at the end of the table. They were all crying. No one ever told me my dad was dead. They didn't have to. Their tears told me, and their silence told me. Even the slump in my mother's shoulders told me that life was never going to be the same. Later, I'd pieced together fragments. He'd been at a fire, and just when they thought the building was clear, someone thought they heard a cry from inside. It was too hot and too dangerous by that stage, and Dad wouldn't let his team go back in. So he went in himself to do another sweep, and while he was inside, the roof collapsed. I never saw his body, and I wasn't allowed to go to the funeral. And so it was a long time before I really believed he was dead. Instead, to me, he was just gone. He had simply left, and I knew that was my fault. Dad had swapped shifts that day so that he could be at the assembly for me. He should never have been at that fire. It rained the morning of his funeral. Lexi and I had to wait at home with one of Mom's elderly aunts, but we didn't know her at all, and she terrified us. She wore strange clothes and wouldn't let us watch TV. So as soon as the drizzle stopped, Lexi and I hid outside away from her. The wake was at our house, so after the service, dozens of people arrived to make their way up the path to the front door. Lexi and I didn't talk much. We sat in the echoing shock of our grief, watching strangers as they went inside our house to mourn our father, as if we were the onlookers to their tragedy, rather than the other way around. When the procession finally slowed down, Lexi hugged me, and she told me things were going to be okay. But I was sure she was lying, and so I finally started to sob. The guilt, and the grief, and the shock, and the pain were just too much to bear. When her hugs failed to console me, Lexi did the only naughty thing I can ever remember her doing. She walked the length of the path that ran from the street to our front door, and she made a basket with her skirt. And she picked flowers from the agapanthus that bordered the walkway. There were two straight rows of alternating white and purple plants, and Lexi methodically stripped every single petal until they were overflowing from her skirt and she was struggling to juggle it all. I finally, reluctantly dragged myself up from the grass beneath a tree and went to ask her what she was doing. She told me to stand on the lawn, and then she waddled over to my side with the flowers still in the skirt of her dress, and she told me to spin. I resisted at first, but she grew insistent, and so I awkwardly twirled, but I felt stupid and angry. Soon Lexi dropped the flowers onto the ground, and she began to gently toss them over me as I spun. The wind picked up, and my clumsy twirl gradually became more free. I twirled, and the flowers rained down around me onto the lawn, and the sun came out from behind the clouds. And for just a second, life was something close to beautiful again. "Smile, Annie!" Lexi shouted. And at first I couldn't, but as I danced and twirled, the corners of my mouth lifted just a little. And then I did smile. And Lexi smiled too. Soon we were throwing the petals at each other, and then we were dancing and laughing as if the world hadn't really ended 3 days earlier. Lexi caught my wrist in her hand to stop me, and she thumped her other hand hard against my chest, and she said quite forcibly, "Do you feel that? That lightness inside? That's Dad. He's with us still, I promise you. He would never leave us, not ever, Annie." They really were the worst days, Luke. But even then, my brave big sister made sure there was a silver lining.
5. Lexi. I wake the next morning to the familiar sounds of hospital foot traffic on the other side of the door. Sam and I are in the resident's bunk room, and sometime while we were asleep, he pulled me right onto his chest. I offered to sleep on the top bunk, but it didn't take much convincing for me to join him. Although it was cramped, I needed the comfort of his body against mine, and he was right about my state of mind. Even on this taste of sleep, I feel much more rational. I slide from the bed, and Sam stirs.
What time is it?
He sounds like he's in rougher shape than I feel. I glance at my phone and am relieved to find no missed calls. 10. It was just after 5 by the time we got back to the bunk room. Then I was on my phone for a while, trying to figure out how to word the email I had to send to work. I knew Oliver would check his emails the moment he was out of bed, and I knew he could call in a replacement for the next few days. Taking off work was particularly inconvenient as a GP, but necessary from time to time, so of course the clinic had procedures in place. The cause of my hesitation was a vigorous internal debate about whether I needed to reveal that Annie was back on the scene. I just wasn't sure how he'd react, given how close she came to costing me my job last time. So for a good 10 minutes, I typed and then deleted text, until Sam impatiently took the phone and drafted the email for me. Oliver, I'm so sorry. I've had a family emergency. I won't be at work for the rest of the week. I'll call you once I know more. Lexi. As soon as I nodded, Sam hit the send button. That was at 5:15 a.m.
He doesn't need to know any details yet, Sam had murmured as he pulled me down onto the pillow. We can deal with it later. Things must be going well if the staff on the ward haven't called, Sam surmises now, and I have no doubt about that.
He made sure his colleagues in maternity knew to contact us for any change in Annie's condition. This hospital is his domain, and I can tell he's highly regarded. Sam is a surgeon, a man who works with his hands, but at heart, he is a devoted people person. He has chosen this career for no other reason than that he cares very deeply about his patients. I smooth my hair into a ponytail and wait for Sam to pull his jeans on before I open the door. We walk hand in hand back to maternity, and Sam politely responds to countless greetings as we make our way through the halls. At the ward, he goes to speak with the nursing staff and to see if Eliza Rogers can spare him a minute or two, as I head to Annie's room. She's resting against the pillows watching television, a tray of untouched food in front of her. The color in her face is better, but she still looks drained. How are you feeling?
Tired, but the headache is gone.
Annie hits the remote to turn the television off and struggles to pull herself into a sitting position. I help her, adjusting the bed and then offering my arm for her to drag herself upright. Have you seen the obstetrician?
Yes, her name's Eliza. She came in a while ago and said things are looking better than when I came in.
I'm going to need much more detail than that, but I know Sam will be able to give me a better picture of Annie's situation after he talks with the staff. My mind races forward to the next challenge, and I say to Annie, we need to call Mom. Even though my mother and I are hardly close-knit, I'm sure that she'd want to know about this situation. Mom mentioned to me in our last call a few weeks ago that Annie had been calling her, too, and I assume they've rebuilt something of a closer relationship while Annie and I have been apart. So I'm surprised when my sister shakes her head.
Not yet. Please, Lexi, give me a few days, okay? It's not like she's going to be angry that we didn't call her straight away. She probably won't even care.
Don't say that, Annie. It feels strange to defend Mom, but in this case, I'm sure that Annie is wrong. She does care.
Maybe. She just has a funny way of showing it sometimes.
Annie mutters, and she picks up a piece of toast, breaks off the crust as if she's going to eat it, but then lowers it back to the tray.
I have been speaking to her a bit more lately, but I haven't exactly been honest about my situation. so she doesn't know about the baby or that I'm still using, and she's going to be upset with me for lying, and I just want to be able to tell her I'm on top of this before we call her, okay? I just need to be clean first.
Thoughts of Annie's relationship with our mother, clearly as confusing as my own, fade to the background as I focus on her other bewildering statement. Clean? Annie is staring out the window, her gaze distant. I lean toward her as I say, very gently, Annie, you can't actually detox until the baby is delivered.
What? Of course I can, Annie says stiffly. I know I've messed up until now, but with the right help.
No, I don't even mean you can't. I mean, you shouldn't. It's not safe. Withdrawals would probably start premature labor. She stares at me. Her blue eyes are clear and I have her full attention, but I can see from the twist in her eyebrows that she still doesn't understand what I'm telling her.
But I nearly did it at home a few times. I was just going to do it alone. I tried.
Probably a good thing you didn't. I smile at her gently, and she shakes her head. The lines on her face seem endless, and when she frowns, the hollows in her cheeks grow deeper. Annie looks too frail to be the weapon of mass destruction I've known her to be over the past 6 years. I take her hand in mine and squeeze it tightly. There are well-established protocols for dealing with addiction in pregnancy. I'm sure Eliza will have a plan.
But you said I could take the methadone just once.
Well, yes, I did, but I mean, you have to be taking something.
But I can't stay on methadone.
Annie is visibly frightened of this possibility. She hates methadone, and she always did seem miserable on it. Then again, she always ended up using while she was on it, and I've never been sure how much of her misery was put on to preempt the inevitable relapse. I'm instantly impatient with her, assuming she's going to resist the maintenance treatment so she can go right back to using street opiates. I'm surprised when she whispers desperately,
Lexi, methadone withdrawals are as bad as heroin. If they put me on that, won't the baby still have to detox once it's born?
Now I'm confused. I'd assumed her fear and concern were all about her own dislike of methadone. It hadn't actually occurred to me that she'd be concerned for the baby. I soften a little at her uncharacteristic display of selflessness. There are alternatives, I say gently. But yes, it doesn't matter what the maintenance drug is. The baby will have to detox, no matter what happens from this point.
But I was just going to stop before it comes. I can't let the baby.
She chokes up, and she's getting wound up. This is the very last thing she needs, given the situation with her blood pressure. Her naivete is completely heartbreaking. I want to pull her into my arms and tell her that it's all going to be just fine. But that would be a lie. It's not. There are ugly times ahead for her and her baby, and as soon as that thought strikes me, I feel the pinch in my chest as I acknowledge that this means there are also ugly times ahead for me and for Sam. I want to protect Annie, and I know we need to keep her stress levels down to help control her BP, but pretending there is anything like an easy solution available to us now is ridiculous. Now, anger rises within me so suddenly that I'm caught off guard by it. I'm half inclined to cut this conversation short and storm down the hallway to ask this Eliza what she was thinking by not making this clear to Annie in their very first meeting. There just has to be a way for me to get clean before the baby comes. She's thinking out loud now, digesting the implications, her voice shaky and rough, but determined. As if she could somehow negotiate with me to find a way to change the workings of human biology just for her. Lexi, you have to make them find a way. You don't know what detox is like. It's not something a baby should have to feel. Annie, I've watched you go through withdrawals. I do know what it's like, and we know how to help infants go through it. It's going to be okay. Annie shakes her head, lips pursed. I'm not letting my baby start its life like that. It's too late to avoid that now.
But what if I stay in the hospital and just go cold turkey? They can monitor the baby, right?
With your blood pressure the way it is, the last thing you or the baby needs is severe stress like withdrawal. You could go into labor. Or even worse. There's a slight pause. Then Annie whispers hesitantly,
Worse?
I work to clear the lump of guilt in my throat before I can bring myself to admit. The baby would probably go into distress. There's a much higher chance of an emergency delivery, and a chance it might not even make it. Do you understand?
Fuck.
Annie starts to cry, and I flick my glance toward the monitor. Her BP is rising, very slowly, but the numbers are trending upward, and I need to end this conversation. I didn't mean to scare her, but Annie is intelligent. She can understand this. If she wasn't so upset, I just explained to her about physiological withdrawal, so that she can see that there are complex systems in place here, and both she and the baby legitimately need the opiates for the time being. But she's staring at me as she sobs, and I'm actually starting to wonder if I shouldn't have left this conversation for her doctor. I know you hate it, love, but staying on maintenance is the only way forward. It's the best thing for the baby. The door opens, and I'm relieved to see Sam. But the relief doesn't last long. It's only a moment or two before I notice the police officers right behind him, and a middle-aged woman wearing a white coat and a scowl close behind them. I widen my eyes at Sam, and Sam offers me a silent apology with his grimace.
Ann Vidler?
One of the officers says as soon as he enters the room. Annie does not respond. Instead, she continues to stare at me, as if I can somehow prevent this from happening. I suppose that's fair enough. After all, I did promise that I would. The other officer walks to the end of the bed and checks the nameplate, then nods to his colleague.
Ann, the presence of narcotics has been detected in your urine. Under Alabama law, chemical endangerment of a child is a...
Annie has high blood pressure, I say sharply, and I rise to my full height and address the officers as if I'm her lawyer, rather than her sister, although I'm still holding her hand, and I'm holding it so tightly now that my fingers are cramping from the pressure. It's medically imperative that she avoid stress, so you'll need to leave the room now, please.
Dr. Rogers said that her blood pressure is stable.
All eyes turn to the woman in the coat, who barely hides her disdain as she points to the monitor and says sharply, I told you it was, but that I wasn't sure she was ready for this, and you've proven me right. You need to leave now. The police officers exchange confused glances, until one finally drops some papers onto Annie's bed, and they leave the room. I glare until the door closes behind them, and then gasp in disbelief when one remains right in my line of sight, guarding the door. Now when I look out, I watch a woman approach him. Through the small window in the door, I can see only from her shoulders up, but that's more than enough for me to recognize the no-nonsense demeanor of an unsympathetic professional. She stands with the officer, her expression set in a fierce frown. I wonder what her role is. Are they going to stay? I murmur, and Sam says quietly,
There was some concern Annie might try to leave the hospital. They're just here to make sure she remains until tomorrow, when there'll be some kind of hearing.
He picks up the warrant from where it sits on the end of the bed, and sighs heavily as he folds it up and passes it to me. I take it with my left hand and stuff it into my pocket without looking at it.
Don't you worry, Annie, the doctor says very gently. You're not going anywhere until it's completely safe. We'll probably keep you here until you deliver.
Annie shakes her head frantically. I can't stay here that long. The doctor approaches the bed and takes Annie's other hand in hers.
I know it's difficult, but it's really important that you stay calm, Annie.
She flicks her glance to me.
You must be Alexis. I'm Eliza Rogers. I'll be overseeing Annie's care.
I need to speak with you, I say tightly, because although I'm impressed with her handling of the officers, it's surely her fault that they are here in the first place. Who else would have called in her failed drug test? Besides which, I'm still frustrated by how little she's explained to Annie so far.
Certainly. Eliza nods, but her attention is already back to Annie, who is breathing heavily and fidgeting on the bed. Let's make sure Annie's okay, and then we'll talk.
Sam's hand descends on my shoulder, and I release Annie's hand to turn back toward him. His gesture is one of comfort, but also, somehow, I know it's a warning, a plea for me to watch my tone with his colleague. His gaze locks with mine. Sam is sad, and he's worried, and I take his unspoken plea on board. We do need Eliza, so I can't really afford to make an enemy of her. I reach up, squeeze his hand against my shoulder in another unspoken communication. I understand. Then turn back to Annie. She's staring at the ceiling, and there's a thin sheen of sweat over her brow. Annie is white as a ghost now, and the systolic blood pressure reading has increased by 7 points since I came into the room. It ticks upward, this time skipping 3 points higher, and Eliza releases Annie's hand and says quietly, I'm going to organize some more medication for you, Annie. Something to calm you, okay? As soon as the doctor leaves the room, Annie looks to me. Her eyes are wild with fear and desperation. What are we going to do?
We.
I know that I told her that I would somehow prevent this very thing from happening, but still, her casual use of the shared pronoun frustrates me. This is her problem. This situation is entirely her doing. It's so typical of my sister that she is already assuming that I'm going to create a way out of the mess for her. I can't look at her for a moment. I'm too frustrated. But as I look away, her vitals monitor catches my eye, and my resentment evaporates because it has to. With every digit that number rises, the baby's health is compromised, and so is Annie's. I take a deep breath, and I meet her gaze. Then I offer her a calm smile. First things first, let's get that BP back under control, and then we'll make a plan.
6. Annie. Luke, I wonder what you're thinking about that last entry. I know you're looking for the key that unlocks me. Did you think that was it? Did you scribble down on that notepad of yours, daddy issues, and then treat yourself to a cookie for being so clever? Did you feel sympathy for me? Did you feel pity? Or maybe it was disgust. Maybe you're thinking to yourself, Christ, is that all that's behind this life of disaster? That's her pain? Millions of children a year lose their parents. Why couldn't Annie cope? She's so weak, pitiful. Well, if that's what you're thinking, you're wrong. Because I did cope, Luke. Even as a child, I figured out that life would somehow go on. I knew that it would never be the same, but I understood that the days would just keep coming at me, one after the other, an inevitable tide of time that would not stop even though I felt like my world had ended. Mom, on the other hand, never seemed to grasp this concept. That peak grief she was caught in during the early days after Dad's death never seemed to ease off. Weeks passed, then months, and Mom never got back to living. I figured that one day she'd go back to work, but even months later she still could barely drag herself to breakfast most mornings. And even when she did, Lexi made the breakfast, and sometimes she went as far as to feed Mom spoonful by spoonful, as if Mom was a baby. Our mother lived in her pajamas, and whenever something good happened, like when Lexi still somehow managed a straight-A report card at the end of the worst school year of her life, Mom would smile for a moment, then hug us, but she'd immediately dissolve back into sobs. Over time, her embraces became a source of anxiety for me. If something wonderful happened that I knew Mom would celebrate, I learned to keep it to myself to avoid the inevitable breakdown afterward. Soon, Lexi was doing almost everything Mom and Dad used to do, picking me up from school, doing the laundry and the gardening, and even the groceries on our way home from school. For a while, we did the shopping over 2 days because we couldn't carry all of the bags home at once. Lexi figured it out. She wrote a grocery list, and then she split it into 2 shorter lists to divide the weight. She'd stopped to pop sweets in my mouth as we walked, so I didn't complain about my arms getting tired as I carried my half of the bags. Eventually, one of the guys at the fire station saw us walking home. And from then on, every Tuesday afternoon, we were ferried to and from the grocery store by a uniformed fire department officer. But other than the small kindnesses shown to us by Dad's colleagues and the teachers at school, there were no adults directly involved in the day-to-day workings of our lives. Certainly no relatives coming to check in on us. I knew that Mom's and Dad's parents were alive and even lived nearby, but we'd seen them only a handful of times in our lifetimes. I'd wondered about this, particularly when they came to the wake, but then immediately disappeared again. In the past, when we'd asked Mom or Dad about their families, their answers had been vague. They said that our grandparents loved us but just couldn't come to see us very often. You don't miss what you've never had, not even when everything else goes to hell. And Lexi was at the helm, and life just went on. I still believed in Santa Claus then, and so at Christmas that first year, Lexi made me write a letter and then told me she'd mailed it for me. She convinced Mom to get the tree out of the attic, and then we put it up with Christmas carols blaring on the CD player. Mom watched for a while, but Lexi and I finished as she rose and silently took herself back to bed. I woke up Christmas Day to find a sea of gifts beneath the tree. Santa had come, and there were gifts for all of us. Lexi had the set of Roald Dahl books she'd asked for. I had everything I'd asked for, except, of course, for Dad's return. But even in that case, there was a new photo of Dad framed and sitting on the mantel beside the Christmas tree, smiling down on us as we tore open the gifts. Santa had even bought Mom a new nightgown. Lexi's cooking skills rapidly improved, but she wasn't up to the challenge of a turkey, so she made spaghetti bolognese. Mom came to the table and said grace. She wept afterward, but even so, she stayed until the end of the meal. Lexi and I ate and chattered over the low soundtrack of Mom's sobs. By then, we were so good at drowning out that sound that we barely even noticed. It was a good day, and I remember both missing my father's presence at that table, and knowing that if he really was looking down on us, he'd be so proud of the way that Lexi and I were carrying on. It wasn't an orthodox way for a family to exist, but it did work. Mom's state of mind was confusing, and from time to time I'd get nervous about it. But I still had Lexi, and she managed to compensate for most of what would otherwise have been lacking in that home. Dad's insurance had paid off the mortgage, and we had his pension trickling in. So other than a sign of life for Mom, we wanted for nothing. Lexi kept up with her academic extension classes, and I had a good group of friends at school, and my stories to hide in whenever it all got to be a bit too much. But then, Robert came into our lives. So, keep your notepad close, Luke, and wait before you treat yourself to that triumphant cookie, because shit is about to get ugly.
7. Lexi. As Eliza administers a sedative to Annie, I slip quietly from the room and prepare to confront the woman with the bun. She offers an introduction before I have to ask. Mary Rafferty, she says, extending her hand toward mine. I shake it briskly, and she continues in her broad drawl, I'm a social worker with Child Protective Services. And you are? Social worker? I figured CPS might get involved after the birth, but that's still a long way off. Why would she visit today? Dr. Alexis Vidler, I say stiffly. I'm Annie's sister. Ah, Mary Rafferty says, nodding knowingly. Well, that explains it. Explains what? I wondered how an addict could afford this place. I bristle at the scorn in her tone, but I push down my irritation. I'm tired and angry, but thankfully at least smart enough to realize that a CPS social worker is the last person on earth I can afford to offend at this point. What can I do for you, Ms. Rafferty? Well, CPS will be petitioning the court to strip your sister's parental rights. I'm here to take a brief medical history and get a rundown on her living situation to help the judge with his decision in the case. She delivers this announcement in such a nonchalant, unguarded way that if I listened to her tone instead of the words, she might have been announcing her plans for the weekend. I gape at her. What?
Mary Rafferty gives me a quizzical frown. She seems perplexed by the outrage in my tone, which only outrages me more. Didn't you read the paperwork the police officers brought in? Anne has been charged with chemical endangerment of her child. That's a felony. She's been charged? She hasn't been found guilty. Well, she failed a drug test, and according to a doctor, she's admitted to using heroin. While pregnant, Dr. Vidler. Mary gives me an incredulous look. Surely you as a doctor can understand how serious that is. I can't help it. I flush. I'm embarrassed by my sister's behavior even as I start to defend it. She has an addiction, I mutter defensively. It's an illness. She needs help, not, what did you say? To strip her of her parental rights? What is that going to achieve at this point other than distress the hell out of her? The baby isn't even due for weeks. There's time to sort all of this out. Respectfully, Dr. Vidler, that's not how this situation is going to work. Decisions need to be made about that child's welfare, and your sister is not fit to make them. The child's welfare? What decisions need to be made right now that she's not fit to make? Well, the doctor who reported her to us overnight was concerned that she might discharge herself and attempt to use illicit drugs again. That's obviously not in the child's best interests. Besides which, he said there was some medication she refused. Are you aware of that situation? Medication? I repeat, and I scan back over the events of the day and can't figure out what she's talking about. Until I remember that early morning discussion about methadone. Oh. Well, yes, she wasn't keen on methadone, but she took it eventually. Methadone? Oh, I didn't realize. Well, that's a bit different then. Judges don't generally like to see these addicts go from one drug to another, even if it's a legal alternative. They generally want to see moms in an abstinence-based program. Well, she can't just go to rehab. I snap. She's incredibly sick, and she's pregnant. Going into withdrawal now would be a recipe for disaster. Oh, I see. Mary Rafferty frowns, and then withdraws a notepad from her handbag. Could you spare me a few minutes to discuss this some more before I go in to speak with her? I laugh incredulously. You're not speaking to her, Ms. Rafferty. When those officers came in earlier, her blood pressure spiked, and her specialist is sedating her as we speak. If you go in there, she's going to panic, and she can't afford to. Oh, I'm afraid I'm going to have to insist, Mary says, and she plants her palm flat against her chest and leans forward toward me, offering an apologetic grimace. I really need to get a history here, and also, well, I just have to understand her living situation. I could come back later today, I guess, but I'll need time to put together a report so I can make a recommendation at the hearing tomorrow. You'll have to make do with speaking to me, I say. She's in no state for an interrogation right now. Not an interrogation, Dr. Vidler? Mary gently scolds as if I'm a child. I just need to understand a situation so we can figure out what to do with this baby. I hope by that you mean figure out how to help her care for it. Mary Rafferty's good-natured smile disappears in an instant, and now she seems confused. Dr. Vidler, you can't seriously think she's an appropriate person to care for a newborn? You've literally never even met her. How dare you make a judgment like that? I hiss. I'm infuriated. Just then the door opens and Eliza and Sam emerge. You might want to take this conversation away from Annie's doorway. She really needs to sleep now, Eliza murmurs. Good idea, I mutter, and I use the interruption as an opportunity for a deep breath to try to deal with my own blood pressure. We take a few steps farther into the corridor, and Eliza and Sam linger until I offer introductions all around. Dr. Rogers, Dr. Vidler here was just telling me that Anne isn't well enough for a chat today. Can you confirm that? Mary says quietly. Yes, I'd much rather you left it, Eliza says, frowning. What's the rush?
I need to prepare a report for Anne's hearing tomorrow. For the judge, you understand? Mary says, then she glances back to me. I guess you and I could cover the basics, Dr. Vidler, if you don't mind. Of course. I sigh. I do mind. I just want to go back into Annie. But I know the alternative is Annie having to do this conversation, and I know we can't afford that right now. And I'll need to speak to you too, Dr. Rogers, Mary adds. Could you spare me a few minutes sometime today? When you are finished with Alexis, find my office and have my secretary call me, Eliza says abruptly. I've got rounds to do now. I'll come as soon as I can. She gives us a curt nod and shakes her head a little as she walks briskly away. Can I join you? Sam asks, and I hesitate. I don't even know why. It just doesn't seem right that Sam should have to sit through this. But then again, he heard most of it last night, and I'm frazzled, so the idea of backup is appealing. Thanks, I murmur, and I take his hand. Let's walk up to the meeting room, shall we? Mary murmurs. We can finish this conversation there. Actually, Sam says, would you mind if we go to my consulting room? It was a late night. I suspect both Lexi and I could do with some coffee, and we'll be much more comfortable there. You're a doctor, too? Mary says, and her eyes widen again, as if she just can't make sense of two successful professionals having any connection to a failure like my sister. I want to wrap my hands around her skinny neck and throttle her. Instead, I clench Sam's hand tighter, conscious of the sharpness of my gaze, but unable to prevent it. Well, certainly, Dr. Hawk, lead the way. Sam's receptionist brings a pot of coffee and some cookies, and we sit around the little conference table in his office. Mary sets her notepad and a clipboard with some printed forms onto the table, and once she's added sugar to her coffee and thanked Sam for his hospitality, she turns her gaze back to me. I just want to be very clear, Dr. Vidler, she says quietly. My role here is to help the court keep that precious little baby in your sister's belly safe. I'm not here to judge, I'm here to help. The state of Alabama has terrible issues with drug-addicted babies. Babies cannot be drug-addicted, I say tersely. It doesn't make any sense. There are two components of an addiction, a physiological component and a psychological component. The correct term is physiologically dependent. That's not the same as drug-addicted. Well, sounds to me like you're splitting hairs, but it doesn't matter much. You can use whatever term you want, Dr. Vidler. Your sister has been abusing heroin while she's pregnant, so I'm sure you're aware her little one is in for a world of pain once it's born. Her decisions to this point suggest to me that she's not fit to continue making choices that affect the welfare of her child, which is why we are petitioning to remove her parental rights. Is that what the hearing is about tomorrow? Sam asks quietly, and Mary nods. Yes, that's correct. Judge Brown will consider my report and make a ruling. If he rules in favor of our petition, well, if her specialist does agree with your assessment, Dr. Vidler, and Anne can't go off to rehab or detox just yet, then I'll recommend that she remain in custody either here or via incarceration until the birth, just to keep the baby safe, you understand. We need a lawyer, I say, exhaling, and Sam nods. I glance at him. Should I go find a lawyer before we discuss her history? Oh, no, Dr. Vidler, that's not necessary. Mary gives a gentle laugh. No, this is just background about Anne's medical history. I'm a social worker. I'm not making any decisions myself, just gathering the facts to assist the court. She offers me a consoling smile. So why don't you start at the beginning and tell me how long your sister has been an addict for? I give her as little detail as I can, but still, I'm racked with guilt as I speak to the social worker, as if I'm betraying Annie just by telling the truth. I skim over years of frustration and pain, providing only a reluctant list of points. Mary's expression is grim when we start,
and by the time I reach the events of the previous night, she's stopped writing and she's staring at the table. I'm not even sure she's listening to me until I stop mid-sentence and Mary looks up. There's sadness in her gaze, and I have an odd spurt of adrenaline pump through my body as I realize that she has already made up her mind.
"Well," she says quietly, "thanks for your time."
"Annie can beat this," I blurt, and Mary hesitates.
"Dr. Vidler, you're clearly a devoted sister, and I respect you for that."
"You didn't even ask about her living situation," I say. "This is just not fair. Mary has such a small part of the picture of Annie's life. How can she decide her suitability as a parent based on only her history of rehab attempts?"
"Let me guess, Dr. Vidler."
Mary sighs as she packs up her notepad.
"She's either living with you or she's on the streets. Which is it?"
"She has a trailer," I snap. "It's not the Shangri-La, but it's a roof over her head."
"Does she have a job? A way to support herself? A way to buy diapers and formula and pay medical bills?"
"I don't think so, but she..."
"Look, none of this matters, not really. Not at this stage. Maybe later, once she's been through rehab and she's clean. But I'm sure you can understand. All that matters for now is making sure your sister can't damage that precious baby any more than she already has."
Mary stands and slides her handbag onto her shoulder. "Annie matters too," I croak, and I stand. "Surely helping Annie is the best way to help her baby."
"That's not my area of responsibility, Dr. Vidler," Mary says quietly. "But I'm sure the judge will do everything in his power to give your sister another opportunity to get herself sorted out." "You said Annie will probably go to rehab," Sam says quietly, and Mary nods. "Will she get a say in which facility?" "Well, it just depends on what the judge decides. But why do you ask?" "My employer's opened a new rehab clinic out at Auburn. If Annie has to go into an inpatient program, that might be a good option for her."
"I can certainly make a note of that in my report, Dr. Hawk." Sam rises and walks Mary to the corridor, and when he returns, he stands behind me and gently massages my shoulders. I slump forward and press my fists against my eyes. They're going to take her baby away.
"It sounds like it."
"Is this what we do now? A woman fails a drug test and we remove her parental rights just like that?"
"Apparently."
"This is bullshit. Shouldn't we rush in at her with resources to help her get clean and care for the baby?"
"We're going to need to find that lawyer, Lexi."
"I know." I sit up and exhale. Sam's gentle kneading of my shoulders continues. "But first, I really need to speak to Eliza."
"What are you going to tell Annie?"
I shake my head hastily. "Nothing yet. Not until I talk to a lawyer." Sam's hands slow, then pause, and I tilt my head back to stare up at him. I'm not going to worry her until I know just how bad this is. The social worker made it seem bad. The cops made it look bad. But what do I know? Maybe all she needs is a decent lawyer to untangle it.
"Maybe,"
Sam murmurs, but I can tell he doesn't believe it any more than I do. "This new rehab place?" I prompt him.
"Maybe it's a long shot, but I thought it might be worth mentioning. They have intensive recovery programs from 4 to 12 weeks, and since it's owned by the same company, we'd get a reasonable discount on the fee. Plus, it's only an hour away, so that's a bonus."
"Okay," I say, and I rise. I need to get back to her in case she's woken up. We return to Annie's room to find her still dozing lightly, so we quietly take the visitor's chairs to wait for her to wake. I pretend to play with my phone while Sam reads a newspaper, and the silence is a relief. I'm flicking through my Facebook feed, but I don't see anything that flies past me on the screen. My mind is elsewhere, back in Sam's office, reliving the conversation with Mary Rafferty. Maybe I could have liked Mary if I'd met her in another professional setting, one where she and I were on equal footing instead of this messy encounter. Now that I'm calmer, I can recognize that she was almost charming in that polite, friendly way I've grown to appreciate after 8 years in the South. I'm still bristling at the way she leaped to judge my sister. But I reluctantly acknowledge that's probably necessary for her job. How many times a day does she have to quickly assess a child welfare situation? Her intentions are probably good. Surely no one would work for CPS unless they genuinely cared about children. But that doesn't change how completely, bewilderingly messed up all of this is, or how maddening it is that the state's first response is to grab for Annie's parental rights. I'm only hoping that an attorney can make sense of this.
Lexi?
Annie's eyes are still closed when she speaks suddenly, and I startle.
Yes?
You're tapping your feet, and it's driving me insane. I didn't even realize I was doing it. I press my feet hard into the floor and mutter, "Sorry." Annie wakes properly then, and after toying with the cookies and juice box that someone left on her table while she slept, she asks Sam if he will do her a favor.
"Sure,"
he says warily.
"Can you get Eliza?"
she asks. Her voice is small, and as soon as he leaves the room, I prompt her, "Are you in pain?" She's scratching herself again, and her eyes move quickly around the room, like she's scanning for an escape route. I frown and approach the bed.
"What is it, Annie?"
18 hours, she mutters.
"What's 18 hours?
"Since I scored, Lexi. 18 hours since I scored. Maybe they can give me a little morphine? That's safe in pregnancy, isn't it? Just a little, I won't need much, just to take the edge off."
"You've already had the methadone,"
I murmur, and Annie scowls at me. "Fuck methadone. Did you see the dosage he ordered me? 20 milligrams. You think that's going to keep me out of withdrawal? I need something more." The door opens and Sam and Eliza interrupt what was probably about to become an ugly sparring match.
"Let's chat," Eliza says, and she helps herself to a seat at the edge of Annie's bed. "Feeling okay?"
"No," Annie says abruptly, but then she sighs. "What's the plan?" The overall picture Eliza presents to us is murky. Annie and the baby are stable for now, but if there's any change at all in their condition, Eliza will deliver immediately. In preparation for this, she's giving Annie a series of steroid shots to mature the baby's lungs, because there's also no telling how long it's going to cope with delivery.
"It's surely going to be tiny, with an estimated size of only a few pounds."
"The baby is suffering from what we call intrauterine growth restriction," Eliza tells Annie carefully. She then goes to great pains to point out to Annie that this might just be related to the high blood pressure, and perhaps it would have happened anyway, even if narcotics weren't a factor. "I know that it isn't as simple as that. Perhaps Annie's high blood pressure is just genetic, and the baby's reduced size just bad luck. But heroin abuse in pregnancy tends to restrict the growth of the baby. And then there's Annie's poor lifestyle. And in any case, if Annie had been under proper medical care, she'd likely have been on bed rest and medication to manage all of this before it impacted the baby's development."
"So if things remain stable," I ask Eliza, "when will you deliver?"
"Ideally, we'll keep the baby in utero for another 4 weeks," Eliza murmurs, but I can tell from her careful tone that she's not optimistic about this time frame.
"And how are you planning on managing Annie's withdrawal symptoms?" Sam asks quietly. "I consulted with an addiction specialist this morning, and he agrees that methadone is the best option for you, Annie." My sister gives a frustrated groan, but Eliza's gaze doesn't waver. She presses on patiently. "There are alternatives we might have considered if your condition wasn't so complex, but given that there are a lot of moving parts here, we want you to stick with the methadone. We know it's completely safe." Sean ordered you a very low dose last night, Eliza explains. He thought it best to treat you conservatively, given how unstable things were. But seeing how quickly you're experiencing withdrawal symptoms, I'm suggesting a much higher dose.
It won't work anyway. Methadone has never stopped me from using.
Okay, Tell me about that. Why doesn't it work, Annie? Eliza asks gently.
It just doesn't!
Annie snaps at the doctor. The frustration and impatience in her tone seems inappropriate somehow, perhaps because of how carefully Eliza has prompted the question. But Annie is coming apart before our eyes, and all I could think is, thank goodness we didn't tell her about the social worker. I'm not sure Annie would be up to dealing with that news just yet, and she's clearly not kidding about the withdrawal symptoms. She's trembling, and the hands that have been resting on her belly press her hair back from her face behind her ears. Then again, when the hair falls forward immediately, and she groans in frustration and clenches her hands into fists.
You know it doesn't work for me, Lexi. I was on methadone when I was at your place last time, and that was a disaster.
Annie, I say softly, this time just has to be different. You don't have a choice this time. You can't just go cold turkey. And don't you think it's going to look better for the judge tomorrow if you start some treatment before the hearing? I don't tell her about Mary's comments about judges not liking maintenance programs. And if I'm honest with myself, I'm not sure I understand it. How could judges not like one of the only evidence-based treatments we have to offer people suffering addictions? I make a mental note to clarify this with the attorney.
Well, I only came here in the first place because you said you wouldn't let them charge me.
Annie snaps. I open my mouth to respond, but Sam interrupts flatly. And if Lexi hadn't convinced you to come here, your baby might not have made it even this far. I shake my head at Sam furiously, but he persists, and I groan in frustration as he pulls all of the coldness right out of his tone, as he adds quite calmly, Lexi can't fix this for you, Annie. Annie is staring at him through narrowed eyes, but he shrugs, unaffected by her anger. This is your mess, and there's no easy way to fix it. No easy path out of trouble this time. There's simply no painless solution for Lexi to find. Annie's nostrils flare, and now she and I are both staring at Sam. He has no right to speak to my sister like that, even if he was defending me. But nothing he has said is untrue. Every single word was simple, uncomfortable truth. I'm so torn, a jumbled web of contradicting emotions. I'm angry with Sam, I'm angry with Annie, I'm grateful to Sam, I'm worried for Annie. I don't care if it's painful. We just have to keep the baby safe, and then we have to find a way that I can keep it. Annie croaks. I don't care what happens to me, I just want my baby to be okay. Can't you all see that? I can see it, I whisper, and I fumble to wrap my fingers through hers. Annie looks at me, her gaze desperate, her eyes filled with tears. Lexi, I want to do better, she chokes. I want to keep my baby. I'll do anything, I promise. What you said earlier? Are you absolutely sure there's no way to stop the baby from experiencing withdrawal? She's directed the question to me instead of Eliza, and this time I catch myself before I take charge. I look at Annie's obstetrician, who shakes her head sadly. I'm so sorry, Annie. There's probably not. Sometimes babies exposed to narcotics in utero do avoid NAS, but it's rare. Annie sighs and wipes at her cheeks, then rubs her temples. When she speaks again, she's pitiful. Her tone is completely flat and she's staring into space. So I don't have a choice, then. Oh, God, Annie. You have no idea yet how little choice you're going to have. You have had a choice, I say suddenly. Annie looks to me in shock, and I realize she's assuming I meant about using the drugs in the first place, so I clarify hastily. You've chosen to come here with us and do the right thing for your baby. You could have kept burying your head in the sand and stayed at the trailer. I know that would have been easier. So don't sell yourself short, okay? Annie slumps again. So if I stay on the methadone, can I go home? Oh, no. Eliza winces and she shakes her head. No, that's absolutely not an option, not given how unwell you were when you came in. You'll need to stay here in the hospital until you deliver.
But I can't afford this place, Annie whispers. She slumps forward, wraps her arms around her bump again, and says flatly, "I can't stay here."
"We're taking care of it, Annie," Sam says quietly.
"I don't even know you. I can't let you do that," she snaps.
It's amazing how quickly Annie's miserable desperation morphs back into anger and resentment. As her desperation for a fix mounts, her mood will become increasingly unstable.
I know from experience that if she's not sufficiently medicated soon, this easy irritation will grow and grow until her rage is completely out of control.
"Lexi knows me well enough to agree to marry me," Sam points out. Then he flashes her his most charming smile. "I know that you want what's best for your baby, Annie. I barely know you, but even I can see it plain as day. This hospital can provide you with the best medical care in the state. Eliza is one of the top high-risk obstetricians in the country, and we have a neonatal intensive care unit on site. This is the place to be, Annie."
"What do you think?" Annie glances at me. "Do you really want me here, at your fancy boyfriend's fancy hospital?"
"Not even a little bit. I want what's best for you and for the baby. And Sam's right. You're not going to get any better care than you are here."
Annie takes a deep breath, then bursts into noisy sobs. "I'm sorry. I really am. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry about all of this. Sorry that you've all been dragged into it. Sorry for the baby. But if they take it away, I just don't know how I'll live with myself."
The grief on Annie's face is unbearable. I stand and wrap my arms around her, pulling her hard against myself. I press my lips against her stringy hair, and guilt washes over me like waves. She smells like her trailer, like poverty and addiction and a total lack of self-care, and it's wrong. This is not who Annie was supposed to become. I rub my hand up and down her upper arm and note automatically the sinewy muscle beneath my fingers and the bone. It's all too close to the skin. It's a miracle that Annie has been able to sustain a pregnancy at all. "Annie," I say, my voice low and urgent, "all that matters is doing what we can now for you and the baby, okay?"
"I'm going to try harder. I really am. I really want to be a good mom."
"And you are going to be," I say firmly. But I have to add a silent prayer, even as I say it, that the court gives her a chance to at least try. But step one has to be staying in the hospital and starting on methadone. A proper course, a decent dosage, enough to really hold those withdrawals at bay. Annie clears her throat, and she forces out a long, slow breath. Then she wipes her eyes with the back of her wrists, and as she snakes those skinny arms back around her belly, she offers me a single, silent nod. I'm spellbound by this compliance, this relatively easy agreeability. I try to think of the other times Annie agreed to use a maintenance program, but the years have blurred in my memory, and all I remember for sure is that it has always been difficult to get her on board. She used to complain of bone pain, agonizing, supposedly, right from her first dose. I'd researched this and found that narcotics withdrawals can cause pain, but Annie was always on a high enough dose that this should never have been a factor. I'd eventually come to the conclusion that it was just yet another excuse, setting up the scenario so that when she used again, she had something to blame. But Annie has never had a reason outside of herself to stick with the maintenance programs before. It's always just been her. As I consider this, I'm startled by a burst of optimism. Maybe she can make it work this time. Maybe the baby is reason enough for her to finally, finally get her shit together. Good. I breathe the word on a sigh of relief, and Eliza rises immediately. I'm going to go organize the prescription, and we'll increase that methadone right now, before your withdrawal gets any worse, okay? You know how this works. The symptoms will stop almost immediately.
Thank you, Annie says unevenly.
Can I speak to you for a minute, please, Alexis?
Eliza asks quietly.
but there's an undertone of tension, and I realize that I've known Eliza for all of 10 minutes, and I've already pissed her off.
You already did.